that same vaccine denier who's getting hospitalized with severe COVID-19 is putting his arm out and say, pump it into me, is a complete contradiction. It doesn't make any sense.
Today on the Politics Podcast, a conversation with former state health director, Dr. Jeffrey Engel. Hi, I'm Jeff Tabiri. Hope you're well. Vaccine mandates aren't new. Neither is the hysteria by some against them. Yet what was more of a fringe argument has entered more of the mainstream. Following months of comment section debates and the latest round of misinformation, vaccine rates in the U.S. have sputtered.
So we're talking about a medical countermeasure in immunization that works.
Dr. Jeffrey Engel was the North Carolina state epidemiologist from 2002 until 2009. Then from 2009 until 2012, he served as state health director. He's certified in internal medicine and infectious diseases. Engel also later served as executive director of the Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologists.
And the thing that people don't seem to be opposed to are our medicines, medical treatments. So we don't hear a lot of pushback on the Regeneron cocktail or Remdesivir, which is an antiviral drug. So it's really odd to me that people are willing to go ahead and get sick and look for a drug that you can pour into my veins and save my life. I'm not going to protest that. And Remdesivir, by the way, has still not been FDA approved. It's still only available for emergency use authorization. But so that same vaccine denier who's getting hospitalized with severe COVID-19 is putting his arm out and say, pump it into me, is a complete contradiction. It doesn't make any sense. So I'm saying that we have medical countermeasures against this. One is a preventive vaccination. The other is our medical treatments. I'm much more for prevention. Makes a lot more sense.
Many elected officials, Democrats and Republicans, have called for such prevention, and they did this even prior to FDA approval of the vaccine. Still, success has been limited. So last week, President Joe Biden issued an executive order mandating inoculation for federal workers and federal contractors. Private sector workers, an estimated 80 million who have not been vaccinated, will now face the requirement to do so or submit to weekly testing. While experts say Biden is on strong legal footing, vaccines are, by constitutional definition, a state's issue, and legal challenges are to be expected. In a moment, you'll hear Dr. Engel address the anti-vaccine shift during his career in public health, and later, the mandates already in place for children. But we begin with what he says is his duty to promote the vaccine.
You know, as a medical doctor and a specialist in infectious disease medicine, and as an epidemiologist studying population health as well, I view it through that lens. And so, like anything in my oath that I took when I became a physician, the first thing we say is to do no harm. We mean that seriously. So in addition to doing good, we must also ensure that we do no harm. And that part of the oath of a physician is basically vaccine safety. So it's incumbent upon me as a medical doctor to ensure safety to a reasonable extent possible. I think the pushback coming from the public is multilateral. I mean, I can tell you what I hear. One is that this is new, particularly the newer technology of using an RNA molecule to instill an immune response. It's the first time that we've ever used that platform for an infectious disease. So I can understand why there's someone who might be hesitant to receive this new technology. My question back is, how long do you need before you feel they're safe? It's been over a year now since people who entered clinical trials received mRNA vaccines. There's nothing emerged yet, but also mRNA technology is not new. It's been in use for other diseases for 10 years without anything unexpected adverse events. And here we have a pandemic that could kill you. I can't think of any other better benefit or make you quite sick. And we do know that the vaccine is really working well to prevent serious illness.
It is fair to say the reward far outweighs the risk with the vaccine in your perspective.
Yes.
Any issues that you have, any hesitancy or any ambiguity, do you have any concerns at all over the vaccines?
Well, I'll just say this, that no vaccine is 100% safe. We've been living with lots of what I call very, very low risks that we find acceptable. So I will never say that this is 100% safe, and no one would ever say that. In fact, we have mechanisms in the United States to compensate people for vaccine-related injury. So that's how serious we are about, you know, admitting that these things are not 100% safe. But again, it's the risk-benefit ratio. And when the risks of an adverse event, an injurious event are so small, then we realize we need to move forward with broad mandates for acceptance of the vaccine.
And we're going to get to some of the mandates already in place here in North Carolina in a moment. But I'm interested for you as an epidemiologist, somebody who's been involved in this world for a long time, for decades. How would you, if you can think of it, conjure it up, how would you have described the anti-vax movement, platform, mouthpiece, say in 1991 versus today? Can you juxtapose those two?
Yeah, it's like nothing I've ever seen, because it seems to obviously have taken advantage of the major political divisions that we're seeing in the United States today. And for some reason now, an anti-vaxxer is a Republican and a person who believes in vaccine is a Democrat. I never would have believed I would have saw that in 1991. In 91, we were dealing with medical exemptions, which are, of course, obvious, and religious exemptions, and then people who had what they called personal objections to vaccines, which are not allowed in North Carolina. So North Carolina has one of the strictest vaccine requirement statutes in the United States, which allow only medical exemptions or bona fide religious exemptions to vaccine. And this is for school-age children, where they are mandated in North Carolina. So that was my frame in 1991. It was a small fringe of non-believers. And of course, the bona fide religious people who respectfully, you know, were able to avoid vaccines as well. Flash forward to 2021. As I said, to have this somehow translate to a political affiliation to me is totally unexpected and extremely sad and disturbing.
List off for me, please, the vaccines that are presently required or mandated by our state.
Sure. And I should say that this is a North Carolina general statute, and it's for all children. So this is for people under 18 years of age. But these are things like diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus, that's the DPT, measles, mumps, and rubella, that's the MMR, polio, pneumococcal disease, which causes pneumonia, Haemophilus influenza type B, which causes meningitis, meningococcal disease, which causes meningitis, hepatitis B, which is given to the newborn to prevent hepatitis type B. These are the ones off of the top of my head. Of course, there's a list that's in North Carolina Administrative Code in rule that you can access as well, that has the complete list.
Some of these, or many of those that you just mentioned, have been around for decades, yes?
Yes.
What has been the resistance, the outcry, those who are seeking an exemption or refusing to get vaccinated in not recent weeks and months, but in years and decades past. How would you describe it? Is it a small slice of the population? Is it sizable? Size that group up for us.
Sure. So let's begin with children. I think these are the vaccines that are given to children, both newborn period and prior to entry to school, and then during school age. And they're widely accepted. So I think the rub comes with adults, so people 18 years and older, because there are no mandates to vaccinate adults. There's nothing compelling in North Carolina statute or any in the United States that I'm aware of that compels an adult to get vaccinated or they will be excluded from some activity. So that's where we are, is that adult immunizations in the United States doesn't have the force of the rule of law like it does for children. These things come into play is in are the employer mandates. So when I was working, for example, in medical care, my employer required me to be immunized against everything that we talked about for the kids. So in my occupational health experience, I would need to get boosters periodically. I was required to get the flu shot annually. I was required to get the chickenpox vaccine if I had not had chickenpox yet as a child, you know, on and on and on. So certainly in healthcare, adults are used to mandates from our employers. And this, of course, is not just to protect the healthcare worker, but also protect our patients.
And briefly, what are the exemptions or exceptions for parents of children in North Carolina?
The exemptions would be a bona fide religious exemption or a medical exemption.
You obviously cited the political divisiveness, which makes sense. I think anybody who's paying attention would say that's obviously part of what's going on here. You also note a new, and I was never good in science, but a new approach to coming up with the COVID-19 vaccine that might lend itself to some hesitancy from people. Are there other factors of note that lend to this this larger moment right now?
Yes, and I think I'll take some responsibility on this one, which is I think a failure on behalf of science and medicine, both in the practice and research wing, and as well as the government wing, to communicate effectively to the public what we're doing and what we're studying and what our results are. We tend to be viewed as elitists and paternalistic and in our messaging to the public, and we need to do a lot better job communicating. It's not easy, though, because the world that we're in is very technical. The field and science of vaccinology is very, very subspecialized. So We do need to work on that. And I think a lot of what has happened during COVID-19 has been a failure to communicate effectively how vaccines work and the efficacy versus the safety risk-benefit issues.
So I hear you, but let me, I guess, push back in a weird way. Is that really on you? And with all the disinformation and all the anti-science sentiment, how can you and your field possibly combat that?
Well, point taken. Obviously, when I was in government, we worked with very skilled communication people who could work with our, you know, as a technocrat and work with our technical language and turn it into plain English. That certainly helps to have a good communication person working with you on that. But you're right. There comes a point in time when we have to just say, you know, some people are just not being rational here and listening to the evidence. And it's not a communication issue. It's more of a belief system that's very difficult to deal with.
One of the things I have read in recent days is that it is not, it is in line with the cycles of history for there to be hesitancy and resistance to new vaccines and to push back against mandates. So that, in some ways, this isn't unprecedented. Acknowledging that, I wonder, and I'm asking you to speculate a little bit here, but I'm wondering if you were concerned about the lagging vaccination rates and what that could mean, whether it's for the next 6 months or 6 years, or what it could mean for North Carolina's statutes for the requirements for some of these vaccines. Do you take the moment we're in and extrapolate it out? And are you similarly a cynic? Do you have concerns, or am I just reaching here?
No, I think your question is a good one. And the way I frame this is that we just don't have any legal infrastructure in the United States for adult immunization. And we've relied on the employer mandates, but the government has never weighed in on this. We have court decisions. So there's the landmark Jacobson versus Massachusetts case that went to the Supreme Court in 1904 that every public health practitioner can quote line and verse to, where a man refused to get a smallpox vaccine, and the Supreme Court ruled that indeed the state can compel a person to be immunized, or that person can be excluded. So we don't rope people down and jab them. What we do is then issue isolation and quarantine orders so that they can be excluded from employment, from other freedom of movement, freedom of action. So that's been how we manage this. But we just don't have a regular schedule of adult immunizations that are required like we do with school-age kids.
An offshoot follow-up here. I was having a conversation with an editor before you and I came on, and we were talking about how this all factors into healthcare premiums and the Affordable Care Act. And I'm just going to – I don't have a question formulated for you, but I was thinking about this through the framework of like smoking cessation programs, right? So like you don't get docked for being a smoker, but you get a little carrot, you get a benefit for saying, I don't smoke. Is it conceivable that we are heading to a place within healthcare premiums, where if you attest to being vaccinated, or if you prove that, it is somehow, there are multiple tiers or multiple paths within healthcare? Is that on the horizon?
Well, that's a good question, and I'll push back on your parallel to smoking, because smoking is a personal choice, and it affects only your health if you choose to smoke or not. Of course, we have laws that prohibit you from smoking in indoor spaces that are shared by the general public, so that's good. But you can go outside and smoke all you want and have a premature death. But not getting vaccinated, your choice affects my health. This is where public health crossroads occur. So this, you can say the same thing with sexually transmitted infections as you can with COVID-19. Your behavior or your irresponsibility affects my health, because you didn't tell me about your sexually transmitted infection and you gave it to me. That's a problem. And that's where public health law and rule come into play, and where people can be compelled by law to change behaviors. So this is where I think the employer mandates are coming down, is that they want a safe workplace. They also want their businesses to keep running. And with an issue like COVID-19, which is a respiratory pathogen and can just affect anyone within 10 feet of you or 6 feet of you, it's just a generally good business decision to require it of your employees. So I see the path coming in our capitalistic society more down that road rather than government mandates, because I just don't think that'll fly in the United States.
Money drives the train. Always has, will for a long
time.
Plus,
there's always been a large anti-nanny state sentiment in the United States. You know, the government is not your nanny.
Dr. Jeffrey Engel is the former state health director. Prior to that, he served as the state epidemiologist. During our conversation, he mentioned vaccine requirements for kindergartners as required by state law. North Carolina does track how many incoming public school students are vaccinated, how many are taking a medical or religious exemption, and how many do not report their status at all. My colleague Jason DeBruin, who reports on data and healthcare, recently got his hands on the most recent numbers, vaccination data, for the academic year that began in 2020. And last year, at this time, there were nearly 108,000 kindergartners enrolled in public schools.
There were a 0.1%, a very small fraction, who claimed the medical exemption, but about 1.5% that claimed the religious exemption. And the total number for which there was no vaccine record was 4.3%. So again, 108,000 new kindergartners, about 4,700 of them unvaccinated to measles, mumps, rubella, polio, etc.
How does that compare with the year before and the year before and the year before?
So it's actually down a little bit from last year. It's actually up from the year before that, but it actually is down kind of significantly from the middle of the decade. So the biggest spike that we saw was in 2016, 17, and 18 in those two school years. That's where we saw probably the biggest jump that we've seen in the past decade was in those 2 years. It settled back a little bit. 2018-19 was actually low compared to the other years, but we've sort of settled into that again. But about 4,500 or 5,000 in any given school year. So they're sort of at that 4 to 4.5% would be sort of considered, you know, quote unquote normal here for the past half of the decade. Though again, I'll reiterate that is well above levels that we were at in the early part of the decade. So 2011, 12, 13, 14, numbers there were much lower.
It's also fair to say 95% at least of North Carolina kindergartners are vaccinated. So these rates are pretty good.
Yeah.
These rates are pretty good. At the same time, we're having this separate conversation, not pertinent to pertaining to kindergartners, but specific to adults and the COVID-19 vaccine, which is new. I mean, there are other elements to that conversation, but is there anything to be gleaned? Is there a bridge that you would connect or not connect here? Does this tell us that vaccination rates are likely to dip for kindergartners in a few years? Is this likely to say, hey, we are more likely to vaccinate kids than we are ourselves as adults? What does this tell you, if anything? I might be reaching.
Well, no, I mean, these are the questions. I mean, this is exactly what I'm curious about. And one of the reasons why, you know, I'm sort of happy to have started this story, you know, four years ago, and we'll continue to pull the thread and get these reports year by year, because I'm very curious what's going to happen in, say, you know, 2025, when kids that were born this year are entering kindergarten, right? I mean, at that point, will DHHS include in its report that students need to report if they're vaccinated against the coronavirus? That could be very interesting. I'd be very curious to see that, you know, and how will that affect numbers? I don't know this, but it sort of seems to reason that if you have you take exemption to one or more of the vaccines, that you would take exemption to all of them. I don't know that. I suppose there might be some for which you feel it safe and others for which you don't. But I suspect that it's a bit of an all or nothing thing. And so if there are people who are coming out against the coronavirus vaccine, the COVID-19 vaccine, that they then would not want to have their children vaccinated against these other, viruses as well. That's certainly possible. These are answers, unfortunately, these are answers we're just not going to know for some time, because just the mechanism of how the state has been calculating these numbers are based on when you enter kindergarten. So there's no law that requires preschoolers, for instance, to be vaccinated. Now, it seems to reason that, you know, people have received their vaccinations at that point, but nobody's checking yet, or nobody at the statewide level is checking. So we won't know how the pandemic and resistance to the COVID-19 vaccines affects childhood vaccination rates for these other viruses, really for 4 or even 5 more years. But that certainly will be something to keep an eye on in the next half decade.
The Colleague is on Twitter at JASONDEBRUYN. As always, thanks for listening to the Politics Podcast from WUNC. We'll be back with you on Friday for a review of some of what is happening in North Carolina politics. My name is Jeff Tiberi. Enjoy your week.
WUNC. Bye.